Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 104 for August 12th, 2007. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll put your questions about whiskey to the experts in the first Q&A episode of Whiskey Cast. First, though, let's look at the news. Ever since Glenmorangie was acquired by LVMH 3 years ago, whiskey lovers have been waiting for the French influence to take hold. This past week, the Herald reported that Glenmorangie's going luxury in line with other LVMH brands. The way the Herald put it, Glenmorangie is going from Gaelic to Gallic, dropping the simple wine names on its finished malts in favor of names like Nectar d'Or. Now, if my high school French is correct, that loosely translates as Nectar of Gold. The Herald also reports that Glenmorangie plans to raise its prices by as much as £10 a bottle to make it a more exclusive luxury brand. Now, there's no official word from Glenmorangie on the rebranding effort, but if you take a look at what's been done with its sister distillery Ardbeg's high-end releases over the last year or so, it's clear that something may be in the works. Now, if they start referring to the 16 hommes de Tain instead of the 16 men of Tain, that's a sign they may have gone a bit too far. More new whiskeys to talk about this week, including two vintage Laphroaigs. Just 75 cases of a Laphroaig 27-year-old are being released this fall, and only in the UK, France, and European duty-free stores. There's also a new Laphroaig 25-year-old that will be a little more widely available, with 550 cases being released. That one is scheduled to be available in the U.S. in the fall of 2008. Also, Isle of Arran has a limited edition release honoring retiring distillery manager Gordon Mitchell. He's been running the distillery since 1995. Gordon's dram is available only at the distillery and by mail order. If you want to be a hit at your Burns Supper next January, Bonhams in Edinburgh has an item up for auction later this month that's pretty much guaranteed to make you a Burns Supper legend in your own time. On August 23rd, Bonhams will put lot number 1049A on the block. It's an 18th century silver hip flask that Robert Burns not only owned, but used. Charles Graham Campbell of Bonhams explains.
I think just the story, the provenance about this actual flask is what is good about it.
What is the provenance?
Robert Burns used to travel round Scotland as an excise man and get to all parts. In fact, his father was from Aberdeenshire, but on this particular juncture, this whiskey flask, hip flask that he had, this comes in connection with a friend of his called Captain Rutherford, who lived in the borders of Scotland. And Captain Rutherford and Robert Burns were quite good friends, really, and it's been noted in Burns' writings that, you know, he was a good friend, and they used to go out shooting and hunting, and in the evenings would drink together. And Robert Burns, obviously left behind this hip flask, whiskey flask, on one occasion when he visited the Rutherfords, and it has been in their possession, their house, ever since, really. Their house was called Hunt Hill, and it was near Jedburgh in the Scottish borders. And so that's really where it's come from. It's come from direct descendants of the Rutherford family.
What do you place as a value on this, potentially?
We've got a value in the region of £600 to £800. That's our sort of estimate at the moment. But as with auctions, there isn't really ever a ceiling on these things. And, you know, some things relating to Robert Burns can fetch, indeed, a lot more. And we've put a sort of, I suppose, conservative estimate on it, just to show the fact that, you know, we mean to sell it. It doesn't have a big reserve on it or anything like that, but we would like to see it sold, and hopefully a few collectors of this sort of thing will come out of the woodwork and bid up and buy it. But it wouldn't surprise me if it makes goes on and makes a few thousand.
And in fact, you could probably make the argument that a flask that Robert Burns actually drank from is probably priceless.
Certainly, exactly. But, you know, there is a precedent, because some of his, there's been a snuff mull of his was sold not that long ago, a little ram's horn snuff mull, silver mounted and inscribed with his thing that was sold quite well a few years ago. So, you know, there's a little bit of a precedent, the fact that, you know, things do come up for Robert Burns.
Why is it being sold at this time?
Well, we have a Scottish sale, which encompasses all items Scottish, whether it be silver, jewellery, arms and armour, books, furniture, paintings, and, you know, other items with a Scottish provenance and history. And this obviously fits the bill very much. It is a popular sale for Bonhams as an international auction house, because we get sent items from Bonhams offices and sale rooms around the world for this sale. And also we sell things to expatriate Scots from around the world after the sale. So it's we have buyers from Australasia, Europe, the Americas, as well as our homegrown buyers too.
There's a link to the flasks page in the Bonhams online catalog at the WhiskeyCast website, and I'm sorry to say, the flask is empty. Finally, Templeton Rye will be available in Chicago legally for the first time later this month. If you heard my interview with distiller Keith Karkoff in episode 87 last April, you'll recall that Templeton Rye was distilled by Iowa bootleggers back in the dark days of Prohibition and smuggled into Chicago, where it is said to have been the favorite drink for one Al Capone. It's the first time the legal version of Templeton Rye has been sold outside Iowa, and the distillery has a week's worth of events in Chicago to celebrate. You'll find the details in the calendar of events section at the WhiskeyCast website. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. Over the past several months, I've been asking you to send me your questions about whiskey and taking those questions to the experts for this first question and answer episode of WhiskeyCast. John Wolfile of Orange, California emailed me this. After reading David Wishart's Whiskey Classified, I started to question, when did single malt scotch start here in the U.S.? Well, John, there were a handful of single malts around for many years, primarily Glenfiddich and the Glenlivet. But to answer the question in depth, I talked with Steve Fox, now the national sales manager for Price Imports. But during the 70s, Steve ran one of the largest retailers on the West Coast, Red Carpet Liquors in Glendale, California.
Back in about 83, 84, you know, I started, you know, trying to collect more, and when I really wanted distillery bottlings, and, you know, Macallan was just barely even a name in this country. I had Highland Park, I had the original Talisker, Oban, Tomatin, some Bowmores, Springbank and the old ugly black label, and there was maybe around 20 or so, 25 distillery bottlings in about 85, 86, there's a couple more. Then all of a sudden, Cadenhead came around and Gordon McPhail, and that enabled me to bring up to about 100 single malts. So I would say it was mid to late 80s where, you know, you can even get about 100 single malts in the country. And then pretty much when the 90s hit, then it became more and more merchant bottlers. And then, especially in the late 90s, everybody's chasing after what Cadenhead was doing. Because all through the 90s, Cadenhead controlled the merchant bottling business in the U.S., and today there's about 15 different ones available in the U.S. market, which created too much competition for Cadenhead, and they got frustrated with all the you know, high-low price wars, this and that, and everything else, and they pulled out of the market. So, you know, mid-1980s was the very, very, very beginning of the single malt interest. I wouldn't say the craze, but the interest. The craze didn't start until the late 80s, early 90s, and then it started getting more and more appealing, and it's all history today.
And before that, it was primarily blends, right?
Correct, yeah. Oh, it was, blends were, that was it. Johnny Walker Red, Johnny Black, Petty, J&B, Dewars. Those were always mountain floor stacks in my store before.
That was really the case worldwide. We didn't see single malts outside of Scotland for the most part, right?
No, not at all. You know, in Scotland was always Glenmorangie, but no, the single malts weren't, I mean, nobody really thought of them. I mean, of course, there's always Glenfiddich, Glenlivet that were the leaders worldwide. But past those, nobody even knew, I mean, people really didn't even associate Glenfiddich or Glenlivet as a single malt, and it was never marketed as a single malt. It was just marketed as the next step that was more expensive. And so those really, I say, started the stepping stone. But it didn't. It took all the other distilleries to send it to the next level.
John, hope that answers your question. Now, fellow podcaster Shelley Brisbane in Austin, Texas, is a bourbon lover, and she emailed me a couple of weeks ago. You often talk about special bottlings of whiskey, both scotches and bourbons, and I'm wondering if you can suggest sources for these limited-run bottlings that just don't pop up in my local liquor store. I'm not asking for info about a specific bottling, but just your general advice about how to find such things. I live in Austin, Texas, a mid-sized city. I'm a bourbon fan, not a scotch drinker. I get the impression that it's easier to find specialty or higher-end single malts than bourbons. Do you think that's true? I am by no means an expert, just a fan of great bourbon. Well, Shelley, I'll take this one. Depending on where you live in the U.S., there are great specialty retailers that can ship special orders to you. I have a few listed on the links page of the WhiskeyCast website. But, Shelley, while Austin is one of my favorite towns, unfortunately, it's smack in the middle of Texas, which has some of the nation's toughest laws on mail-ordering whiskey. Basically, you can't do it legally. As far as the availability of limited-edition bourbons compared to scotches, keep in mind that bourbon distillers have to comply with federal laws that limit what they can do and still be able to call a whiskey bourbon. I've mentioned a couple of Chardonnay-finished bourbons from Woodford Reserve and Buffalo Trace in recent weeks. In both cases, they had to negotiate special labeling terms with the government because technically what they made was bourbon at one point, but once it hit the Chardonnay casks, couldn't be sold legally as bourbon. The Scotch distillers have more leeway as long as they stick to the slightly looser UK laws that do allow for some creativity. Shelley, thanks for your question. And if you'd like to check out Shelley's podcasts, I have links posted on the WhiskeyCast website. Jason Speck of Gaithersburg, Maryland, sent in two questions, and they have such widespread appeal that I decided to get answers for both. First, he asked, sometimes when I nose a new whiskey, I try to see if I can detect what they mention in the tasting notes. Sometimes I do well, and other times I don't. Is there anything I can do to improve my ability to nose? Jason, let's get the answer to that question from one of the best noses and blenders in the business, John Glazer of Compass Box.
To begin with, most individuals have a good sense of smell. Okay, in that they can detect differences in different aromas. Most people do have a good sense of smell. Some people have a far above average sense of smell, so they can detect things at lower thresholds than other people can. And some people don't have the sense of smell at all in extreme cases, or might be, sort of have less abilities than the average person. So we all fall somewhere in the spectrum, somewhere in there. Most of us in the middle, some above average. And sometimes those people with above average sense of smell are able to put that to use in a line of work, whether it's perfume, whiskey, wine, whatever it might be. Right. So that's the first thing to understand. Next, language. Before I get to language, let me talk about the next aspect as I see it. So we've all got this, most of us have a basic sense of smell. The next thing it's involved in what we do as nosers, blenders, and so forth, whether it's whiskey, wine, perfume, or whatever, is it requires two other aspects, an ability to focus on what you're doing, and memory, the ability to remember different things that you've encountered, okay? And that focus, you've got to focus on what you're doing and you've got to think about it, okay? And then it's kind of difficult when you're tasting, I need to taste through 50 cask samples in a day. The way I deal with that is typically by doing them in flights of six, and I take breaks in between flights and I spit everything I taste. I don't swallow. And even though you do spit, you do get some alcohol absorbed into the bloodstream. And so focus does become an issue after a certain point, but you've got to maintain focus to do this job well. So focus, memory. You've got to be able to remember things, okay? And then the final aspect is vocabulary, okay? And you've got to remember the smell, the aroma, and you've also got to remember the vocabulary you're attaching to it, okay? So all these aspects are involved in developing, one's nose, as people say. Again, whether it's for whiskey, wine, perfume, or whatever. Now, vocabulary. Why is your listener You know, sort of still struggling with the vocabulary despite effort. And let's assume he's an above average nose and he's got good abilities of focus, powers of focus, and he's got a great memory. What's going on here? There's this vocabulary issue. And we describe certain things as, say, medicinal. Okay, a peaty whiskey might come through as medicinal to someone, iodine. Okay, well, iodine is pretty specific. Okay, so once you smell iodine when you're a kid and your mother slathers it all over a wound, you kind of remember that very specific smell. Okay, other smells, when you get into the areas of fruits, pear and apple start to sort of flow together. The esters that are responsible for those two aromas can get kind of close to one another, okay? And so what might be an apple to one person might be a pear to another in certain circumstances. You've got these kinds of vocabulary issues. But the main thing is that everybody applies the same word to the same aroma. Now, there's something that people in whiskey, for example, use frequently, which is waxy. What the hell does waxy mean? Okay, are we talking about candle wax that your grandmother used to, you know, grandma's candle she used to burn at the table when you were a kid? Or are you talking about the wax you used to wax your car? Are you talking about the wax you used to wax your skis, so on and so forth? Waxy is a difficult one, but it is used among blenders and distillers, but only because everyone has come to understand the aroma that we mean when we say waxy. Okay, and that the only way you can do that is by interacting with people, you know, being at the same tastings, being on the same tasting panels. When someone says, "Oh, there's waxy character," and everyone else goes, "Oh yeah, okay, that's waxy." Whether I knew that's what waxy was or not, I now use waxy to refer to this aroma. So you've got the vocabulary that some of it's obvious, iodine, some of it's not so obvious, waxy, but comes to be understood by people in the industry or by amateur, by tasters through interaction with others. You develop a vocabulary in the same way that a gang develops its own slang. So how's that for an answer?
That's a pretty good answer. One of the things, and tell me if this works for you, one of the things that I suggested in my response to this listener was that you just start noticing the smells around you. If you're walking through the supermarket, go through the produce section and notice what the different herbs smell like and the different fruits and the different vegetables.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And go through the bakery and notice what, say, fresh bread smells like and make that mental memory so that when you encounter it in a whiskey, it would work. Mm-hmm. At least you'd be able to remember it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a good step that someone could take as well?
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. It is one of the first steps is to become aware of aromas around you and begin to, again, focus on them, think about them, assign some vocabulary to them, okay, and catalog them in your brain. That is absolutely a first step. One thing that I've gotten into in the last year or so, Dave Broom introduced me to a book about the perfume industry. A book about a guy named Luca Turin, actually one book that Luca wrote himself, and then a book written about him, Luca Turin. And it opened my mind opened my eyes to the world of perfume, and there are so many analogies. I mean, we'd always talked about analogies with perfumists and so forth, but when you get inside the industry and how the perfume, people who assemble perfume really operate, really opened my eyes and enlightened me to new ways of thinking about whiskey flavors, aromas, and blending. And what I've started to do is actually I'll go through, I travel a lot, and I go through duty-free shops where they sell millions of different types of perfume. You'll find me in there getting the strip stamps out, you know, smell strips, spraying men's perfume, women's perfume, all sorts of perfume on the strips, and smelling them. And having read those books about Luca Turin, Luca describes what's going on in some of these fragrances. He rates fragrances the same way people in the whiskey business rate whiskeys. He describes them and classifies them. And he talks about what are the classic perfumes out there, both men's and women's. And I find it absolutely fascinating and really good, I think, sort of training in the way you're suggesting to develop a vocabulary for aroma. It's fun too. You know, I'll stick these smell strips and I'll stick them in my pocket after I'm done, and I'll be on an 8-hour plane flight and pull them out, and it just suddenly those aromas like take me back to be back there in the store. They sort of energize me in a weird way. There's some physiological reaction that happens as well, but I can't explain that. It's fun though.
And theoretically, your wife benefits from this because you buy some of the stuff to bring home, right?
Yeah, theoretically, she should be benefiting from this.
Jason's other question has a long-term focus. I've heard and read a lot of conflicting info about how soon you should finish a bottle of single malt after you open it. Some say you should finish it within the year, or the whiskey will lose its flavor because of oxidation. Others contend that as long as you keep the whiskey away from heat and light, it isn't a problem. What do you think? As Jason's question said, there are different points of view, but not everyone with an opinion on this question can actually back it up with experience. John Hansel is the editor and publisher of Malt Advocate magazine and has more than 1,000 bottles of whiskey in his collection.
In theory, if you don't open it and you keep it in the shade at room temperature, in theory, it's not going to change at all. It will basically remain in its current state indefinitely. Now, there are times with some bottles that have the crowns, the corks or the crowns or whatever, that do leak, and you do have some oxidation even before you actually officially open up the bottle. And I've experienced that with some whiskeys in the past. But for the most part, let's just say that, for the most part, you're safe if you don't open up the bottle and keep it in the shade at room temperature. Now, once you open up the bottle, you're creating a greater opportunity for the whiskey to oxidize. And that basically means, what happens when a whiskey oxidizes, we often refer to it as collapsing in the bottle. The flavor of the whiskey just gets dull. It just goes flat. It loses its liveliness. And a lot of the flavors are still there, but they're muted. And it's fairly uninspiring. It's just sort of a letdown. And that you don't want that to happen with your whiskey. Now, there's a lot of variables coming into play here. One is, how long is the bottle open? Another variable here is, how much of the, how empty is the bottle? In other words, what's the surface area to volume ratio? And then, because the higher the surface area, to volume ratio, the more exposure to the oxygen, the more chance of being oxidized. Same thing with the longer the time is in the bottle. As far as the longer the bottle's open, you have the same situation. And then also the third thing is the strength of the whiskey. If it's a cask strength whiskey and it's 57% or 114 proof, it's got more of a chance that it's going to stick around and maintain its integrity longer because of its higher strength than if it were something that was like 40% or 80 proof. So you got three different factors going on here. How long has the bottle been open? How empty is the bottle? And what's the strength of the whiskey? And, so all these things come into play. So you can't really pick a specified time, like how long can you keep a bottle open. You've got these different variables in play. I think you need to be aware of all three of them and, what that impact of those variables are on any whiskey that you have open. I personally, obviously, you can imagine I get sent a lot of whiskeys to review. I have my own whiskeys in my own personal consumption. So I've got a lot of bottles of whiskey open. And I'll give you my rule of thumb, which is very unscientific. But it's a lot of fun. What I do is, I don't really worry about it a whole lot until I get down to, maybe a third or a quarter of a bottle. Usually it's about a quarter of a bottle. And then I just usually invite some friends over, and we drink it. It solves the whiskey problem, and usually ensures a good supply of friends too. So anyway, that's my answer. Obviously you don't want to have a three-quarter empty bottle of whiskey laying around for years. There's no reason for that either. That means you're not enjoying your whiskey. So really, the whole oxidation thing and if you're a regular whiskey drinker and you're enjoying your whiskeys, which you should, then this should be almost a moot point, really.
It's an argument that some whiskey lovers make that some whiskeys actually benefit, say, from being opened for once or twice and for a couple of days or so, just to let some fresh air get into the bottle, and it sort of mellows things out for the whiskey at some point. Do you buy into that?
Well, I'll use a theory that in many aspects of life, a little bit of bad can be good. You know, for example, there are beers that are, beers aren't traditionally meant to be sour, but sometimes beers that have an infection of certain bacteria or yeast strains, like some of those made in Belgium, something that's bad actually can be a good thing. And here's another beer example. Sometimes beers that are really strong and big to begin with, with a little aging, and with oxidation. Oxidation can actually add a new variable and a flavor component. And so if you're having a whiskey that is really like a big, bold, peaty, smoky, you know, high testosterone kind of a whiskey, you know, and if you don't want that, you know, if you have the bottle open for a little bit and it's sort of like, you know, like I said, mellows it out or makes it dull, you know, a little dulling in theory, I guess, could be a positive thing if you didn't want something that strong and aggressive to begin with.
Jason, thanks for both questions. I'm sure you're not the only one who was wondering about them. Finally, Lear Blitzstein had a question for me, and it's the same one you've heard me ask in many of my interviews. He wants to know what whiskey I would pick for my final dram. Lear, I wish I had an answer for you. Since I'm still exploring whiskeys from all over the world, it would be presumptuous of me to try and pick one now. Check back with me in 20 years or so. By then, I may have narrowed it down a bit. In closing, I'd like to thank Steve Fox, John Glazer, and John Hansel for answering questions in this episode, and thanks to everyone who submitted questions. I still have some that I wasn't able to get answered in time for this episode, but I'll have another question and answer episode coming up soon. If you have a question you'd like to ask or a suggestion, my email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2007, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.